funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does a journalist make the transition from covering local news to covering some of the most dangerous conflict zones in the world? And how is the job different if that journalist happens to be a woman? Kim Barker had a solid and well-respected reputation as a reporter when the 9/11 attacks shifted America's attention to South Asia, but she had little experience in world travel or Islamic culture and none at all as a foreign correspondent. Still, she longed for a challenge in her professional life and a change in her personal life. And as an unmarried woman without kids, she realized she was in a better position than many of her colleagues to take the risk. Within 4 months, she was filing stories from Pakistan and Afghanistan and went on to log 5 years as South Asia bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune. Kim Barker is now a reporter with ProPublica based in New York City. Her new book is called The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Kim, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much for having me, Chris.
Somehow we tend to think of war correspondents as sort of born that way, with this unusual appetite for chaos and for danger. You write that you were not an especially adventurous kid. Did you question yourself when you realized how much you wanted to try this?
No, I mean, I was very much not an adventurous kid. I mean, I was actually scared of things like Halloween candy and that I was going to be kidnapped and I was scared of Cotto salami. I was convinced, like, the little blue Cottos were probably poisonous. But I sort of started challenging myself at a certain point. So if something scared me or it felt challenging, I almost wanted to do it just because it was challenging, to prove to myself that I could overcome my fears. Mm-hmm. And that's very much what I approached doing war coverage with. Like, this will be different. This will be tough. Let's see if I can do it.
And at the time the Chicago Tribune was looking to send more women overseas specifically, what was the thinking about how women might do that job differently from men?
We had always had staff foreign correspondents that were women, and we had a pretty good breakdown between men and women. It was the case, though, after 9/11, when they were starting to send a lot more volunteers from the Metro desk and from the National desk, that there weren't a lot of women who were being sent or who were necessarily volunteering. So I had heard a rumor that they were looking for more women because the editor of the Chicago Tribune was a woman, and that's when I threw my hat in the ring by indeed calling myself single, childless, and expendable.
What did you try to learn before you went?
I read everything I could get my hands on. I read books. I read, The Taliban by Ahmed Rashid, the book that everybody reads before going over there. But there's only so much you can do to prepare. I bought headscarves. I talked to people. I tried to, find out what would happen when I got there. But everything in your mind is you're imagining everything. It's all a jumble. You don't really know what it's like until you get there, until you experience it yourself firsthand.
One of the best things you did for yourself was to find an amazing fixer to work with in Afghanistan. Can you tell us about Farouk?
Yeah, I can. Farouk, he was actually a doctor, and he learned to be a doctor during the time of the Taliban, which meant he had to learn anatomy by digging up bodies in a local graveyard, like all the medical students did. He learned surgery, in fact, by operating on Taliban soldiers coming back from the front. And he, after, like so many doctors, young doctors, after the fall of the Taliban and foreign journalists came in looking for people who spoke English, he decided to leave the medical profession and become what's known as a fixer, which is the person for a foreign correspondent that basically fixes their life. They fix interviews, they translate interviews, they fix your computer when it's broken. And Farouk very much was that person for me. And we, for more than 5 years, we ended up working together, became like an old married couple. We would fight and bicker and, swear that we were never going to work together again and then come back and work together again, because I could never really do anything without him. And he's actually in Chicago right now with me as part of this book tour. I flew him in here from Canada. It's his first trip to the U.S. So, and he's just amazed by being able to be here.
And that was a long time coming, right? My understanding is you'd been trying for some time to get him here.
It's true. We had done a visa application for him earlier this year. I mean, when he was overseas, we kept trying to get him in here to go to medical school to try to do something different. But it's very difficult getting visas here. And in fact, he was rejected once this year already. And then we had to actually get a senator involved to be able to get him into the country. that he was told that he could not prove any ties outside of America, even though he was married with three kids. Mm-hmm. But he was very gracious about the whole thing. I, of course, felt incredibly guilty because his country welcomed me in any time I wanted to go there. And he just says, Kim, I am an Afghan man. I expect it.
Are you acting as his fixer now while he's traveling with you?
I am. It's actually very funny. Last night we went to dinner, and he just looks at me and he's like, you're going to have to explain this menu to me and what I can eat. And and friends of mine were with us, and they were just looking confused. And he said, she's my fixer now. You know, I used to do this for her in Afghanistan.
You open the book with this amazing story of your first meeting with a warlord. And I don't know if I'll pronounce this right, but it's Pacha Khan.
Pacha Khan.
And from the beginning, the story is just incredibly surreal. Will you talk about, first of all, what his surroundings were like?
Yeah, we went to go meet this warlord, Pacha Khan Zadran, and it was a good like 4 or 5 hours outside of Kabul on the way to a southeastern town called Khost. This was in March of 2003, the same time when we had switched our focus from Afghanistan into Iraq. And this warlord had been on America's side from the very beginning in pushing out the Taliban, but had recently turned against America and against the Afghan government. So there had been a big firefight, and his son was killed. So Farouk and I decided we wanted to do a story about this warlord, what it was like, why he switched sides, what he thought about what was happening. And he also controlled a large swath of the country. He was a warlord, so... it was just this very beige area, really bad roads going in there. I mean, Afghanistan has always been known for its really bad roads. If you could call it that, they're more like ruts. And so we drove up there, and we park outside his compound and in this van we were in. And his place is just like this, you know, beige little huts, series of little sort of outbuildings, surrounded by hundreds of these militia soldiers who are all wearing like makeshift, you know, army outfits that are hiked very high on their waist with ropes or belts. And they've got flowers, stickers, and Bollywood, you know, actress stickers on their guns. And, you know, they've got long hair, some of them, and they're wearing, you know, cool eyeliner. And we just sort of showed up and said, hey, we want to talk to Pacha Khan Zadran. And he was in mourning for his son, but he, gracious as you have to be in the Pashtun culture, invited us in to talk to him.
We'll get back to him in a minute. Talk a little bit about the Pashtun code and what that means and what it doesn't mean.
Well, it means, I mean, it's a very complicated code, but when you boil it down, it means a few things. Number one, you treat all people who come to see you with incredible hospitality. That means strangers. That means friends. And that means people you don't necessarily like. It means your enemies. If they show up at your front door, you are invited in and you are treated with the same hospitality as a family member or a friend. That's a big part of the code. Another part of the code says you've got to take revenge for any wrong done to you or a close tribe member. And waiting to take revenge can take years, decades. There's a Pashtun proverb that says, you know, a guy basically waits 100 years to take revenge for a slight done to a tribe member from 100 years earlier. And he takes revenge, and then he says, I wonder if I acted in haste. And then that's another big part of the code. And those are the two major parts of it. And then you've got things like, you know, very specific things that must be done if somebody does something wrong. Blood money, the idea of trading a daughter to settle a debt. These sort of things are very much part of the Pashtun culture as well.
So at one point you're there with Pacha Khan, and he asks Farouk, actually, if you are afraid of him. And you say, basically, no, you seem like a great guy.
Yeah, here's this guy sitting there. He looks like a chubby Saddam Hussein, right? Huge turban, wearing this, you know, this bandolier of bullets around him. And, yeah, he wants to know if I'm scared of him. And I say, no, he seems like a really nice guy. He seems, you know, he's very nice. He invited us in. He seems harmless, you know. And Farouk just looks at me, and he smiles and nods. And he turns to Pacha Khan, and he says, and he doesn't tell me this until much later, obviously. Mm-hmm. He turns to Pacha Khan, and he says, of course she is scared of you. She is terrified of you. You are a big and terrifying man.
But, because it would have been insulting for him to think that he couldn't scare a woman.
Yeah, it's because another part of the Pashtun culture is also about pride and about like that whole idea of having a reputation to protect. And it's not about necessarily being a woman. It's about being a man as well. It's like everybody should be scared of Pasha Khan. He's a big and terrifying man.
And Farouk also knew enough not to say that you were an American. He said you were a Turk.
He said it was a Turk. He said, you know, because Pasha Khan says, where is she from? And Farouk says, oh, she's from Turkey. And so Pasha Khan says, oh, well, is she Muslim? And Farouk says, yes, yes, she's Muslim. And Pasha Khan says, well, have her do the prayer for me. And Farouk says, thinking quickly, she's actually a Turkish American, so she only knows the prayer in English. And Pasha Khan just looks at me at that point and says, she's a very bad Muslim. And Farouk says, she is a very bad Muslim.
And later on, you found out that had he known you were American, you might have been in very serious danger.
Mm-hmm. Later on, and I, you know, at the time, I treated it all like a joke, like it was some sort of funny photo op, you know, getting a picture of myself with the warlord, talking to the warlord. How exciting. We got down to Khost, which is a couple hours south of Pasha Khan's stronghold. And in the hotel we were staying at, we ran into these two friends of Farouk, two Afghan journalists who both worked for American outlets or Western outlets. One worked for VOA and the other one worked for Radio Free Europe. And they had just been kidnapped for 4 days by Pasha Khan because they worked for the Americans. And their lives had been threatened, and they had only been freed with the intervention of President Karzai. And that gave me some sort of idea that this wasn't just a joke and that I should probably start taking my security a little bit more seriously.
You describe the fact that in Afghanistan, during much of the time you were there, Western women journalists are treated like a sort of third sex. What does that mean?
Yeah, one thing people always ask is, God, it had to be really difficult being a female reporter there. How would you get the stories? What was that like? And I do use the phrase, we were the third sex. We weren't seen as being like the local women, and we weren't seen as being like the foreign men. We were something altogether different. And it was great. I mean, in some ways, foreign female reporters over there can do the sort of stories and get the sort of access that foreign male journalists just can't get. I mean, we automatically get access to all of the population, not just half the population. For a male correspondent to go in there and try to do stories about, you know, Afghan women struggling against oppression, it's a very difficult thing, and most women aren't going to talk to them. Well, they're going to talk to me. And then I can also go in and talk to many of the government officials or warlords because they're kind of charmed by the idea of these women running around the country, and they're kind of curious to meet you. And at the same time, you're not really seen as having a dog in the fight. You're not really seen as somebody who's going to be kidnapped on purpose or hurt on purpose when you're a foreign woman. And it can be different for the foreign male journalists.
Did the women there have questions for you about what your life was like back in Chicago?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The first time I went to Afghanistan was in January of 2002, and I was on this sort of world food program junket where we were going around and we were meeting specifically Afghan women. And I had the privilege of being there when an Afghan female doctor in Kabul took her burqa off for the first time and went out in public for the first time in years. Mm. She held my hand. She looked at my fingernails. She said, you have really bad cuticles. We have things we can do to fix that. Another woman said to me, are you married? I said, no. She said, good, don't get married. But there was always this real sense with Afghan women that they felt like you somehow knew what they had been through, that you somehow understood what they had been through simply because you were a woman. And while I could certainly empathize and write stories about it, I had no idea what it was like to be them.
My guest is Kim Barker. She's a reporter with ProPublica based in New York City. Her new book is called The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Kim Barker is my guest. She's a reporter based in New York City with ProPublica. Her new book is called The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Kim, you have all this daring and very challenging work taking place, but you have a personal life that is no less complicated, to say the least, than anybody else's. When you first went over there, you did have a very serious boyfriend who, after a while, moved to New Delhi to be closer to you.
Exactly, because I was actually based in New Delhi at the time. So he, about 6 months after I started this job in June of 2004, he moved overseas to theoretically live with me in Delhi, only there was one problem. I was never there.
Mm-hmm. And he had a really hard time after a while, sort of mentally had a breakdown.
Yeah, he had a complete breakdown. It was incredibly difficult for him and, I mean, for me as well, because it actually happened when I was in Afghanistan, and this would have been around the parliamentary elections of 2005. So it was the fall of 2005. He had been in India for almost a year. And just really, he was really struggling. It's a difficult place to live, especially when the person you come to be with is never around.
Yeah.
So, he had a complete breakdown, and he was seeing things that weren't there, hearing things that weren't there, threatening to do harm to himself. And meanwhile, I'm sitting in Afghanistan having to cover an election. Wasn't easy.
Yeah, you couldn't pick up and leave and go help him.
No, I couldn't even. I didn't even feel like I could mention it to my bosses. I think now, looking back, I probably could have, and that I tried to take too much on myself. I tried to appear like I wasn't even a human being to my bosses back home because I thought that's what you were supposed to do. You couldn't be a human being when you were over there. You had to be a machine.
What kind of day-to-day contact did you have with the editors back in Chicago?
It depended on the editor. And at some points, I would have almost no contact. Those were the points I preferred, where you would send emails like, this is what I'm doing over the next week, and they would email you back saying, that sounds good, and you would just file the stories. And then sometimes you would have editors where you had to talk to them every single day, sometimes two or three times a day, which would make sense during breaking news stories in very emergent situations, such as what happened in Pakistan in 2007. But I very much preferred not to have to talk to anybody, to just communicate by email. I mean, talk about a great job. You're halfway around the world from your bosses, and you just sort of write great stories, and you get paid to travel. It's pretty great.
Did they always take your word for it when you said this is a great story if it wasn't necessarily something that was emerging and very important in their eyes?
They did. If I could prove it was a great story, they took my word on it, especially in the beginning. Things changed a little bit towards the end of my tenure there because things were changing everywhere in the newspaper industry. And I don't necessarily blame the Tribune for that. I think they were looking for some way to make foreign news relevant to what their mission was, and considering how much it cost and considering the economic situation at the time.
So how different was the sort of work day when you were in Afghanistan versus Pakistan?
Well, in Afghanistan, we lived this, I refer to it, that section in the book, which is the first section, I call it Kabul High, mm-hmm. for a couple reasons, one of which is just the adrenaline high you get, and the other reason is because it is much like being in high school again, or being in college, where you're all of a sudden thrown together with all these people that have very similar interests, that are there for basically the same reason. And most of them are all of a sudden single, even if they're not really single. And you're all sort of like going through this process at the same time. So everybody works very hard, yet they're in very sort of constrained environments, often working inside buildings, unlike the journalists, we would be out in the field. But most people didn't have that luxury. So, you know, you'd work inside, then you'd go back in, at home and you'd be inside. You couldn't walk down the streets. So for an outlet, it was going to these crazy restaurants, having these crazy parties, toga parties, wear red parties, parties where there were, you know, camels and local Kuchi tribesmen there near a trampoline. I've never seen the sort of parties that I've seen in Afghanistan, to be honest, in Kabul at least.
It's so funny because people imagine, you know, this life as being so serious. And it was, as you mentioned, the journalists, but but it was also people who worked for NGOs and some government officials. But I guess that there's so much pressure that you have to blow off steam somehow.
And there is a lot of pressure, and you do have to blow off steam in some way. I did want to write about that part of the life there because it is sort of revealing the secret that a lot of people don't know. I think PJ O'Rourke mentioned it in the blurb on my book. You know, she reveals a hacks, you know, trade secret, which is like the hell of the holes, is that they're kind of fun. Mm-hmm. And they definitely could be at times. But, you know, looking back and looking at our behavior there and looking at what we were doing there, it did not help the mission of what the West was trying to accomplish in Afghanistan, most definitely. I think a lot of Afghans, particularly in Kabul, the capital, saw the behavior of foreigners as incredibly decadent. And, you know, you have these restaurants there where foreigners are allowed to go to because they serve alcohol, but Afghans aren't allowed to go there. Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine what that would be like to be, you know, an American, you know, in America, and you're told you can't go to that restaurant, but people from another country can.
Yeah, and I guess there's also that sense that maybe they must have assumed that people behave that way all the time, as opposed mm-hmm. to this being a sort of specific time and place.
Yeah, all the time. I think there was a sense in Afghanistan, and I think this happens in any emerging democracy, where democracy doesn't necessarily mean what we think it means, which is the idea of freedom, freedom of choice, freedom of speech, more nebulous sort of freedoms. I think that, particularly in Afghanistan, people saw democracy as equal to sex, drugs, and rock and roll, mm-hmm. you know, and booze and partying and just like this anything goes mentality. And some young people really embraced that in Afghanistan, most definitely, whereas it caused very much a backlash from certain quarters.
So, Kim, you took great pains when you were out in the field reporting to dress appropriately and modestly, but it sounds like pretty much everywhere you went, you got manhandled.
I know. It sounds like, at least in Pakistan, it wasn't very much like, well, I got womanhandled in Afghanistan. Very, very graphically searched by the women there at checkpoints. Yeah, and in Pakistan, you know, anytime you would go to cover a big demonstration or a rally, even like when I was around fellow male journalists, you'd get grabbed. And it's not because I was, you know, this amazingly attractive woman with some amazing rear end. It was more just like the sense that any woman was fair game and any Western woman was fair game. You know, guys would get your phone number off your business card and they would start calling you in the middle of the night saying things like, I love you. My Pakistani fixer, who's a very good friend of mine as well, I don't name him in the book for safety reasons, but he described it to me like this. A Pakistani man sees a lot of these Western women, these Western movies, and thinks that, hey, if I'm lucky enough to put myself in the path of one of these women when she's coming by, maybe I'll get some sex. Hmm. And you can hardly blame a guy for trying, but most definitely being in these situations where you're getting grabbed constantly, I didn't necessarily always react to it well. I punched guys. I, you know, started screaming. I was grabbed at Benazir Bhutto's funeral.
And in that case, you did not punch anybody.
I did not punch anyone there. I held my fist.
Hmm. Talk about this. The former Pakistani prime minister, initially you thought, I've got this great contact. This is awesome. But he had the same ideas that everybody else did.
Yeah, I know. And it's like at a certain point in writing the book, I wanted it to be clear that it's not because I think I'm so great or it's not because of me. This is what happens to every single woman in this situation. I think with Nawaz Sharif, the former prime minister of Pakistan, I joked around with him and, you know, because I pretty much joke around with everybody. And at a certain point during an interview, he asked me to turn off my tape recorder and asked me if I had a friend. And I didn't know quite what he meant. And I thought he meant, like, you know, a friend. And I said, yeah, I got a lot of friends. And he meant a special friend. Mm-hmm. And then after we clarified that, he offered to set me up with somebody and to find me a friend, which I, of course, thought was hilarious. Who wouldn't want to be fixed up on a date by the former prime minister of Pakistan?
It makes for a good story anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you're a journalist, you're like, that would be a good story.
But then it turned out he was also interested in being your special friend.
I know. The two options he came up with for me was himself and Asif Ali Zardari, who is the president of Pakistan, which I didn't think it would be such a good idea, either one of them. But by the time that Nawaz Sharif finally revealed his true intentions to me, he had also already bought me an iPhone. So he tried to give it to me at the same time he gave me the immortal line of, I know I'm not as tall as you want. I'm not as fit as you want. I'm fat and I'm old, but I would still like to be your friend. Which I you got to give him props for his honesty.
And we should say you are particularly tall for a woman.
Yeah, I'm like 5'10". Uh-huh. Yeah.
Was that also something that made you even more striking than other women in your position?
I'm told that. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm told, you know, because I was this tall woman going around, and I laugh a lot, and mm-hmm. That also made me stick out a bit. But I have dark hair, but it's the blue eyes and the 5'10 thing. My editor would always say to me, I want you to blend in when you're over there. And I'm like, how much blending can I possibly do? Although I did get brown contact lenses at a certain point.
Just so that you would be less obtrusive.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Especially in a car. You know, when you're riding around in a burqa or in a baya, you're completely covered in a car and you've got brown contact lenses. Nobody's going to know me from a local.
Going back to Afghanistan, you have some really interesting observations about Zalmay Khalilzad. Would you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, Zalmay was the ambassador in Afghanistan when I first got there in 2004, the U.S. ambassador there, and in 2005 as well. And Ambassador Khalilzad was born in Afghanistan and came back there he was appointed to become the ambassador there and sort of work with Karzai in practically the very beginning. And he really, he knew the culture, obviously, and he just refused to sit at home or he refused to sit inside the embassy. He got out every single day. He would drive his security detail nuts, sitting around having tea and eating until, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning at various Afghan dignitaries' homes. He ate dinner almost every night with President Karzai and had a really good relationship with Karzai and the Karzai government. I don't think it's necessarily a coincidence that in the time after Khalilzad left, that relations between the U.S. government and the Karzai regime started to fall away because there wasn't that sense of continuity there. Karzai became much more paranoid, much more isolated. And I think the only other person that has been over there that has really made that sort of connection with Karzai, who Karzai really liked and liked working with, was General Stanley McChrystal, and that was on the military side of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. My guest this hour is Kim Barker, author of The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You did, is it 5 different stints as an embedded journalist with the U.S. military?
Oh, God. I think it was more like 7.
Okay. tell us a little bit about them and how they were all alike and how each one was maybe different from the last.
When I first did an embed, it was in the spring of 2005. And at that particular point, I was down in the southern part of Afghanistan. And the U.S. soldiers really saw this as a forgotten war. And it was. I mean, nobody was really paying attention to it. Everybody was focused on Iraq. And a lot of these guys that I was embedded with had already been in Iraq, and they really felt like, what the heck are we doing in this place? There's no roads. There's no sense that anybody wants us here. We're not fighting. I spent time with one guy who admitted never being locked and loaded when he went outside the wire, which is, of course, a definite no-no, and it's even more so of a no-no to tell a reporter that repeatedly. They got letters from people thanking them for their service in Iraq, and I think there was a real sense that nobody really understood where they were or what they were doing.
Yeah.
Even they didn't, right? And so they were really a model of what the U.S., the whole view on Afghanistan at that point. As my embeds went along, obviously, things got much more serious. An embed in Helmand was particularly serious when the U.S. had went in there for the first time to the particular area of Musa Qala. And this was in the spring and summer of 2006. And there was a sense that, hey, this is a war. Hey, it's no longer just about handing out candy to folks. It's about them running away when we show up, which is never a good sign. Mm-hmm. And that's really what happened increasingly in the tenor of my embeds, was a sense that, okay, there could be bombs here. They could attack us. And it's much more the sense of us and them and fighting an actual enemy. At the same time, the things that were similar in all my embeds was the fact that these U.S. soldiers, and I only usually went out with the Army, But these soldiers would sort of see this sympathetic woman there and sort of want to tell you everything, and they would just do this download to you about their personal lives, about the stress of all these constant deployments and what it did to their relationships back home. And in many ways, those were my favorite stories to tell about the soldiers. It was about how they lived with war, not necessarily about the battles they were fighting or, you know, doing the bang-bang. I've never been a bang-bang person, though.
Yeah, that's so interesting because although the military is obviously gender integrated, it's still a very male-centric culture, particularly out in those locations where you were. And it's sort of the same thing, once again, they haven't seen a lot of women for a while.
Right. And there was like this sense where they'd just be so happy to get a new one in there and to be able to talk about these things. Because also, I think a lot of their company mates, the people they went out on a regular basis with, were kind of tired almost of hearing these stories. And so to have a fresh pair of ears to listen, a sympathetic woman to listen. And I got really, and it would always be this judgment call because they're telling you all these secrets. You know, I had this guy tell me about how he wasn't cut out for this and how he was made fun of all the time. Mm. And he almost started crying and talking to me. You know, I had guys tell me about their marriages breaking up. And you're sitting there and you're taking notes and you're thinking, okay, this guy knows I'm taking notes. Do I use this stuff when I know that it could blow back on him, or do I not use it? And I always made the call on an individual basis.
Did you want to remind them at any point, hey, you know I'm a reporter, right?
I mean, I would say that occasionally, but they knew I was, and I was there with a notebook taking notes. It's not like my notebook was hidden, and I was sitting there having a normal conversation with them and memorizing things. I feel like that stuff's off limits, but if your notebook's there and it's open and you're taking notes, and by this point, the embed program, it was years old. They knew what they were getting into.
Yeah.
I just think a lot of times when they talked about that stuff, reporters weren't necessarily interested in writing about it, and I found it interesting.
Yeah, because other reporters had been looking for tactical movements and sort of where we were in the war.
Yeah, exactly. And, I'd been there for so long that I would hear these things from the soldiers who had been there for a few months and from, like, the leaders, and they'd say, this is where we are right now, and, you know, we've got to go here and do this. And you'd start hearing the same phrases year after year after year. And when you hear those same phrases time after time, you kind of stop believing them.
Kim Barker is my guest. She's a reporter with ProPublica and author of the book The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is ProPublica reporter Kim Barker. Her new book is called The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Kim, you described this a little bit earlier, the fact that when you are in this really intense situation, you form these really strong bonds very quickly with people. Did that extend to romantic relationships as well?
Yeah, most definitely. And those oftentimes just burned out as soon as you left Kabul or you left Islamabad. We referred to them as locationships as opposed to relationships.
Yeah, because it sort of all made sense when you were in this one time and place.
Yeah, I mean, when you're together, you're thrown together, you care about the same things, you're talking about the same things, and it all just seems so intense and so romantic. And then you're all, you have to run off and cover a suicide bomb, which I know does not sound romantic, but it's the whole idea that you're that close to something that's just captivated the world, that you have the sense that everything you're doing is so important and everything you're writing is so important. which is really what you feel over there. When you come back, you realize, okay, nobody's really paying as much attention as I thought. But when you're over there, it all just feels so intense and so possible.
Was it artificial to not share what you were covering in the event that you were dating someone who was competing against you?
Yeah, there's one time where I was dating this guy, he's Dave in the book, and in Dave, I changed a couple names in the book, which it says in the beginning, Dave and Chris, the other man that I dated, because I figure they signed up not to be in a book, but to date me.
Yeah.
And then I changed the name of my Pakistan driver just to protect him. So Dave, at one point, he was in Afghanistan when I was there, and I was going to cover an episode of Afghan Star, which is the Afghan version of American Idol. Mm-hmm. And a woman, a Pashtun woman from Kandahar, had made it to the finals. So I knew it would be a really good story. And he was just back from an embed, and he really wanted to go with me. He really wanted to also rely on Farouk for the translation. And I sort of ignored it in the beginning because I didn't want him to go, because I didn't want him to take my story, because this is my story. Nobody else had done it. And then eventually it got to the point where clearly it was going to cause a deep fissure in our relationship if I didn't bring him along on this. So we invited him to come there, and Farouk got him in. Then we covered the story together, and we both wrote it at the same time, but his ended up running before mine. So essentially I helped him scoop me on the story.
Was that the end of the relationship?
No, it wasn't. It should have been. there were so many things that should have been the end of that relationship, but it limped on for another few months. Because I think there's a sense, too, and anybody you talk to who's been over there, especially a woman who's been over there, that you really just you want something to be you want to have that part of your life settled. You want to find the person that wants the adventure, that wants to live overseas, and you can have this sort of like the full meal deal. You know, you're married, you can have the kid overseas, and it'll all work out. And I was very reluctant to let go of that fantasy.
So by the end of the time that you spent over there, your brother described you at one point as 100% id.
Yeah.
Can you
yeah.
talk about what that really meant?
What it meant to him was just like I was not capable of like deep thought. Things would happen and I would just react to it. You know, I was drinking too much. I was eating too much. I was feeling too much and wearing my emotions on my sleeve and just really all about, you know, that more than anything else.
But even are you still with us, Kim? Okay, we've just lost our connection with Kim Barker. We'll get her back in just a moment. She is a reporter now with ProPublica based in New York City. She was working for the Chicago Tribune during the years that she was South Asia bureau chief. Kim Barker's new book is called The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email with your question to think@kera.org. Again, we're speaking this hour with Kim Barker about her new book, Taliban Shuffle. Kim, are you back with us?
Yeah, sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay. I'm glad to have you back so easily. Our phones don't always cooperate quite
yeah,
that
and,
well.
Yeah, you know, when I was in Afghanistan, it was always much more difficult to get me back.
Yeah, I can imagine. Talk about this. You were not ready to leave even after you decided the Tribune had declared bankruptcy,
right.
And they said, come back to Chicago and work there. We can't afford to keep you. And you said, no, I want to stay. Talk about how the sort of the end of your time there.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. It's like, talk about PTSD. At a time when the newspaper industry is in incredible flux, everybody was just sort of happy to have a job, and everybody was cutting back on foreign coverage. My newspaper comes to me and offers me a perfectly good job in Chicago, and I decided it's a better option for me to quit and be unemployed in Afghanistan. I think it's just a real clear indicator of how far down the rabbit hole I had fallen and how essentially, at points, I had become very unlikable, and I was just sort of surviving on this idea of adrenaline and being a war junkie. Mm. So I spent some time in Afghanistan that summer, and I kind of started working on this book idea and working on this book proposal. And luckily, at some point, I got offered the Council on Foreign Relations Press Fellowship, which meant that I had to move back to New York. And that, in effect, was a decision. Do I really want to go back there? And I thought, it's only for 9 months, and you can make 3 trips while you're in New York back to Afghanistan, and then you can move back. Hmm. I mean, that's kind of messed up. So as soon as I got back to New York and I started really working on the book and working through it and sort of seeing what it had turned me into being over there for so long and sort of going through the decompression that happens after you come back and the whole idea of getting used to normal life again, I realized that it was just a bad idea for me to go back.
And when you finally left, you said essentially that the place would be forgotten by people like me, foreigners unwilling to fully commit to Afghanistan, but unable to figure out how to stay.
Yeah, yeah. Every time I hear that or I read that last paragraph, it kind of leaves a lump in my throat because it's true. When I left this huge trunk of stuff there with my name on it that went into a room with similar trunks left by other foreigners who fell in love with the place and who just didn't come back. And I do have that sense, like part of me will always be there and stay there. But I certainly am not the person who knows what the answer is there and how to make things right. It just seems to me that we're on this spiral there.
We have an email here from Murali who writes, could you please comment on whether there are any remnants of Hindu or Indian culture other than pop influences like Bollywood left in Afghanistan? And are there still opportunities for U.S. professionals such as lawyers to be useful in the rebuilding efforts?
Most definitely. I'll answer the second part of that question first. Most definitely there are opportunities for American lawyers to help there. I think if you look at one thing that really needs to be fixed there that everybody recognizes, it's the whole idea of rule of law and getting a sense that people are accountable when laws are broken. And I know American lawyers who have actually gone over there and worked on behalf of the Afghan people, like actually serving as lawyers there. And then I also know American lawyers who've worked on projects to try to help establish rule of law. It doesn't mean that it's easy, and it doesn't mean that these projects have a lot of success, but there are definitely opportunities to do it. As far as the idea of whether there's any other remnants of the Indian, civilization there besides Bollywood movies, I mean, there are in certain parts, and there's most definitely art you can buy and sculptures and things like that, but everything was destroyed by all that war. Everything was. So it's difficult to find it. There's Sikh communities there, and they still live there, so they very much embody, you know, that part of India as well.
What kinds of stories do you cover now for ProPublica?
I cover domestic stories, and since we are a nonprofit that does investigative work and then partners up with mainstream organizations to run those stories, I can't really talk specifically about what I'm working on. Mm-hmm. I can say I'll have a couple stories coming out in the next couple of weeks, and it's domestic, which is interesting.
Yeah, my question was what it took to sort of get back into that rhythm, and did it feel like riding a bicycle, or was it an adjustment?
Oh, it most definitely was an adjustment. I did a lot of that adjustment when I was writing the book on the fellowship. I mean, I had to be so insufferable to be around when I first came back because I would want to go out to dinner and I would want to talk about Pakistan and Afghanistan. And a lot of my friends, they weren't over there. They don't want to talk about that. They want to talk about normal things. And I almost would grow very frustrated at the fact that nobody was paying attention. Mm-hmm. I would be out to dinner and I would be looking at my phone, at my watch, constantly feeling like something's about to happen. I need to be doing something. I couldn't relax. I couldn't sit still. I had a hard time being able to walk down the sidewalk and wear normal clothes. Like, gosh, to wear shorts and a T-shirt, that seems like it would be such a wonderful thing after spending so many years there. And I felt almost like it was difficult to leave my house at times. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I've talked to, you know, folks from the military when they come back, that they go through as well, this whole sense of, is this all there is? And what am I supposed to do now? And how can I be normal again, given everything that I've seen?
Yeah, at the same time, I'm sure that when you were there, you would fantasize about all the stuff that you were missing back home. And
sure.
Then you get there and it's not exactly what you remembered.
Yeah, it's more like you fantasize about coming back for a couple weeks. Oh, what will it be like to have sushi that doesn't make me sick? What will it be like to have a nice gin martini with, like, olives that are stuffed with blue cheese? You fantasize about those sort of things, and you get back and you do those things, and then you realize, well, now what? I'm just supposed to live? I'm just supposed to go grocery shopping, of all things, do my dry cleaning? And it just takes a while to adjust. And now I refer to it as I'm better now. I feel like it, the work that I get to do now, throwing myself into a single story or issue, can be as all-consuming as being overseas and covering those things. I mean, fine, things aren't exploding all the time, but you still get to, you know, this whole idea of immersing yourself in a story, which I clearly need.
If it's not evident to people who've been listening to this conversation, we should say that the book is really funny in a lot of places, and deliberately so. Did you ever worry that people wouldn't understand that point of view?
Oh, yeah. The entire time I was writing, even when I pitched it, some people were just saying, are you nuts? You can't possibly write a humorous book about this. And I said, no, I think I can do it. I think I can ride that line, you know, where it's darkly humorous and absurd in parts. In other parts, it's just sad. But when it was coming out, I was really worried, would people get what I was trying to do, that I was creating this self-deprecating character out of myself, and that I was really trying to see it through a certain absurd lens. And thank God the New York Times from the very beginning really loved the book. So I think it set what everybody else saw in the book. And since they got it, it gave people a lens to view the book through.
Well, it's another revelation, too, of the reality that so many journalists, period, but certainly foreign correspondents, have to have that sort of gallows sense of humor.
You do. I mean, doctors have to have it. Soldiers have to have it. The police have to have it. You really get this sense of, like, you just get a dark sense of humor. I mean, like, the night of my going away party from Pakistan, there's this suicide bomb a few blocks away. And my first reaction is, oh, you know, what is this going to mean for my party? That's horrible.
Yeah.
And then everybody was over at the scene, and this reporter from the AP says, well, I said to her, do you think we should still have the party? And she says, well, yes, because otherwise the terrorists win, which is very inappropriate, obviously.
Yeah. Did you, do you feel like the experience changed you wholly for good? Are there things that you feel like are worse in your life having gone through this experience, or is it sort of a blend?
Excuse me. Sorry about that. It's a blend. I'm a much different person than I was before I went over there. I'm also a much different person than I was when I first came back. I'm working on trying to integrate what happened to me over there with the person I was before, which means riding my bike to work, being balanced, being normal, being able to talk about things other than Afghanistan and Pakistan while still really remaining connected over there. I mean, you know, I've got Farouk here with me. I talk to my friends from over there on a very regular basis. But I also think that it's okay to let myself join a softball team, that it doesn't have to be all about that. As far as the other stuff, whether you know, things would have been different if I didn't go overseas. Yeah, I probably would have gotten married. I probably would have kids by now. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely a difference.
It's got to be helpful in a way, though, to be able to give this book to people who don't understand what you have experienced and say, well, at least start here.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That has been very helpful. It's funny. It's like I gave the book to my mother before it came out and to my father as well. And my father, I had told him more about what had happened, so he knew what to expect, but I had sheltered my mother incredibly from what had happened over there. So for her to read it was very difficult, and she got done with it, and she was just like, wow, I'm so happy you're back.
Hmm. I bet she's proud, too, though.
A little bit, maybe.
Kim Barker is a reporter with ProPublica based in New York City, former South Asia bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune. Her new book is called The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Kim, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.